Doc Leipzig, the oldest festival for animation and documentary in the world, is happening in a hybrid format in 2020. We're embracing the opportunities that come along with it. Welcome to the new Doc Industry Program podcast, realized in collaboration with What's Up with Docs, the Programmers of Color Collective, and independent film industry curator Temba Bebe. Welcome to a series of discussions on subjects such as story sovereignty, diversity and inclusion in the documentary industry, and decolonizing our industry in general. These podcasts are funded by Creative Europe, the City of Leipzig, the BKM, and MDM. We thank our partners and supporters for their contributions. Enjoy.
Welcome to a special episode of the What's Up with Docs podcast. This episode is created in partnership with the 63rd Annual Doc Leipzig Documentary Animation Film Festival in Leipzig, Germany. I'm Toni Bell, the creator and host. I would like to acknowledge the traditional ancestral unceded territory of the Tongva and the Chumash on which this podcast is being recorded. We do land acknowledgments as an act of reconciliation that recognizes the traditional territory of the indigenous people who called the land home before the arrival of colonizers, and in many cases, still do call it home. In this episode, I speak with Jessica Devaney, the founder and president of Multitude Films, an LGBTQ-led independent production company, and Emmy, Academy, and Peabody Award-winning director, producer, and editor, Geeta Gandavir. Calls to end extractive storytelling and demands for responsible authorship and accountability in the documentary field have been the rallying cry for many documentary creators who do not belong to privileged groups. In our conversation, Geeta and Jessica examine the colonial roots of the documentary craft, the harmful and sometimes violent ways these practices and points of view are still upheld within the industry by filmmakers, funders, and other gatekeepers, and what needs to be done to make the change. Because it has become readily apparent that those of us who are committed to this change must stay constantly vigilant, this week's song is Public Enemies, Fight the Power. Here is our conversation, which was recorded in October 2020. Hi, Jess and Geeta. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Well, Renelle and I are really both excited because this is our first joint venture. We are doing in this podcast in partnership with Doc Leipzig, and we hope this will be the first of many more. We have really been focused on our own podcast about focusing on issues around authorship and accountability, but also celebrating those artists who are telling those stories within their own communities. That's what we have been focused on. That's what we've been dedicated to. And when we interviewed Bridget O'Shea, who works with Doc Leipzig, and her episode is actually coming out in 2 weeks from now, from the time of this recording. We actually talked about some of the issues that have been arising in the documentary community in lieu of what's happening with the protests around George Floyd's murder. She invited us to do this to kind of give an American perspective, but also to bring attention to the fact that there are questions around authorship and accountability that are occurring in the documentary world in Germany and Europe as a whole, but may not be as visible as they are here in the United States. I just want to get your thoughts on the article by Sonia Childress, who's a senior fellow at the Perspective Fund, but who used to work at Firelight Media, and Natalie Bullock Brown, who works at Working Films. And for those of you who don't know, those two ladies wrote an article called The Documentary Future, A Call for Accountability, appeared on medium.com. And it was really an incredible overview of the documentary landscape and how documentary film itself has its roots in colonialism and anthropology. And I am a trained anthropologist. I have a master's in visual anthropology, so I'm very aware of these roots. One of the first films I watched when I was getting my bachelor's degree in anthropology was Nanook of the North, which is considered a classic, but is so problematic in so many ways. And Sonia and Natalie really give a phenomenal run through of that history and how those the history of colonialism in film still manifests today. So I was just wondering if you could just kind of give us your thoughts on that. Gita, we'll start with you.
Sure. So I think, honestly, when this article came out, I was so thrilled to see it because I think these are questions that, as you know, someone who is part of the BIPOC community, I have been wrestling with for a really long time. And I also studied anthropology. So, but interestingly, when I studied, it was called cross-cultural anthropology.
Yes, me too. Today, so are we telling our age?
I know, but it also sounds super problematic even today. Yes. Like, what does that mean? Isn't anthropology always cross-cultural? Like, what? You know, wasn't it when you think about the colonial roots of it, right? But so I think, you know, for me, these are questions that we have always been struggling with. And in, you know, sort of leading up to this year and kind of the events of this year, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement sort of building in strength and power, there have always been, you know, communities within the film industry that have been doing this work of organizing. So mm-hmm. it's not like sort of the kind of explosion that you're seeing now, or what feels like an explosion of, you know, our voices, we've always been, you know, doing this right. work, but it just sort of maybe perhaps, you know, less attention was paid to us. And also we were within our own groups, again, sort of working on these uniting and building and kind of working on how to change systems, that are currently implemented by those in power. So I think the, you know, seeing this, it just felt like the perfect kind of, sort of a perfect summation of everything that we have been talking about. And I think too, the things that are really addressed in the here, she talks about authorship, accountability, and ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And those are really the key points, that we have all been focused on and we need to continue to focus on going forward.
Right. And just before you respond, Jessica, I just wanted to point out that, like you said, Gita, these are things that we've been talking about amongst ourselves, also to the industry as a whole. And it's at a lot of times being in a position of being thanked for having the conversation, but little has been done to move towards some of these things, or just, I mean, frankly, just ignored. And I think what's happened in 2020 everything that's happened with the pandemic, the political climate in the United States, the protests, what happened particularly around George Floyd's death, because I mean, he wasn't the first Black man to be murdered this year by cops, but this was definitely a unique and the catalyst. There is, I think, a bit of fatigue in that we're tired of having to try to have these conversations, and now we're actually demanding some change. So Jessica, please.
Demanding some change. Yeah, I mean, it's not only the history and heritage of colonialism and kind of the extractive styles and tools of documentary that we're grappling with. We're also doing this work, often, though not always, tethered to social justice movements, but working in a field that's part of like an increasingly corporate industry that is, you know, operating within the inequalities of, you know, systems of white supremacy and heteropatriarchy and all of these oppressive systems. And I think we hit a kind of discomfort in the doc community and having these conversations, because some of the examples that we use to point to about what's problematic, at least in conversations among white filmmakers, it there can be an instinct to be like, well, I didn't do that Matt Heineman thing. I didn't do that other thing, you know, like I'm not quite there. And we really, as white filmmakers, need to be really self-reflective. And I think the community as a whole, you know, questions about who's telling whose stories, and why, and what are the stakes our whole teams have, in the communities, like how much are we connected to how our films will impact those communities when they're launched and released, and what's our ongoing relationship with them. That can be, you know, from a point of points of identity connection, experiential connection. There's a number of ways to look at responsible authorship, but we have to look at it in these contexts of the oppressive systems of white supremacy and heteropatriarchy.
Right. Thank you. Jessica, you brought Matthew Heineman up. Would you and Gita like to talk briefly about what we call here in the U.S. in the documentary community, Tigergate?
Sure. So I can start by speaking to it. I think, as Jessica rightly said, these conversations that we've been having amongst ourselves and that have been brewing for so long, there's a certain amount of frustration that is felt within our communities around the lack of movement and the lack of results, you know, that we're seeing. And after a while, there's a feeling of sort of screaming into the void that you repeat yourself again and again about these issues, but also at great risk. It is exhausting, kind of mentally, emotionally, and frightening to a certain degree to always be the voice in the room, to always be the squeaky wheel, to, you know, you in mm-hmm. some ways you there's concerns about being difficult or being seen as problematic
or inflexible,
risking your livelihood. You know, these are all things we worry about. And this is, of course, with, you know, this is obviously BIPOC folks, but the LGBTQ plus community as well, right?
We're representation. And filmmakers with disabilities as well, too.
That's right. Filmmakers yes. with disabilities. Mm-hmm. Disabilities, filmmakers who are undocumented. I mean, there's so many folks who are sort of feel in many ways and are actually marginalized by the kind of, again, the white supremacist, anti-Black, it's anti everyone else foundations of the, you know, of the film industry, which again traces back to the foundation of this, the country that we live in, of the US itself, right? So I think like a lot of other folks, you know, just feeling extra pained and extra just this year with everything that happens around the murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, the sort of countless murders of Black folks where the perpetrators were not being brought to justice. And then also seeing folks who consider themselves white allies and they are often posting on social media about these issues. You know, they're often side by side with us in marches, et cetera, which is very heartening, but then actually not practicing the anti-racism necessary to make change in their own lives and in their own communities, right? And also within our community, the collective filmmaking community. I think that was something that has been, again, I've been struggling with along with a number of other folks, clearly. And then I think that when the film, the Tiger Woods film, came, you know, was to be released, and there
so
was,
provide some context from folks.
First of all, HBO Sports, right, was the team that wanted to do this film, and Matthew Hamacek was essentially who Jigsaw had, and Jigsaw was the production company, but had tapped to be a director. And this was, again, HBO Sports. They did not feel that he was experienced enough to carry the series. And then Matt Heineman was brought in to co-direct the series. So then you have a couple levels there of gatekeepers, if you will, who are complicit in the way that this series was set up. But again, HBO Sports in particular, I think, sort of, you know, again, not wanting to risk the, you know, what I guess would be their risk the series on a, what they, you know, Matt Hamacek, who they felt was not a seasoned enough director, the, mm-hmm. their choice was Matthew Heineman. So, mm-hmm. And I think, interestingly, in the executive producer line, so Alex Gibney was an executive producer, and Sam okay. Pollard was also an executive producer. Right. So in that line, actually, in the executive producer line, when I, you know, was looking at the film, there was diversity. You know, there was Sam Pollard, mm-hmm. a Black man, and yeah. also my mentor and dear, dear friend was part of the project. So when I look in looking at that line, it would seem that, okay, HBO was doing something correct. You know, like mm-hmm. this was in line with sort of our goals. The rest of the team was entirely white, but save, I believe there was one person who was, is of Asian descent, but was a person who's below the line, you know, right. essentially mm-hmm. was not sort of heading up the team, or, you know, probably not in a position, even though obviously everyone contributes, not in a position to make, you know, again,
not in a power position.
Right. So, and I think my response was really, what I responded to was really the directing line, because the director obviously is the person in the spotlight, the person often, mm-hmm. who often, the directors and producers, right, get a lot of the credit. They are on stage, they're representing the film, they are speaking about the film, et cetera, et cetera. And so I responded to a post on Facebook by mm-hmm. the directors about the issue and asked them, I think what I found maybe triggering, it's easy to be triggered these days, but I found was there were a lot of, again, folks who we consider allies, or who consider themselves allies, I should mm-hmm. say, just sort of say, you know, again, congratulating, you know, the directors on this achievement, but, you know, no one make, you know, taking note of the issues that, again, were so apparent to me. So mm-hmm. I asked in the, you know, wrote to them, said congratulations, but, you know, kind of raised the question of anti-racist practices and
right.
Why they asked them directly why they chose to direct the film.
Because mm-hmm. they had the option to say no, because sometimes as an ally, you have an obligation to sometimes to say no.
Yeah. And again, yeah, right, to ask yourself sort of the difficult questions. Am I the best person to tell this story? How right. diverse is this team? You know, who, mm-hmm. like, do, how am I, you know, again, like, am I doing the right thing, right? And Spike Lee made this film years ago called mm-hmm. Do the Right Thing, you know, which I think we can all refer to. What am I doing the right thing here when it comes to, you know, trying to create an equal playing field, you know, equity and equality is really 90% of what we're asking for in this, you know, and mm-hmm. so those questions have to be asked, I think, for all of us, right? We have to ask those questions, like, am I doing the right thing here? And it seemed clear that that was not the case, you know, right. or that anti-racism was not a part of the agenda in the telling of this very complicated story about a very complicated Black man, you know, mm-hmm, who, mm-hmm. Whose own issues with race and probably stance on race is absolutely shaped by being, you know, raised here in the US, you know,
right. But also a Black and Asian man.
So the specific question was, could one of you not have been, maybe even if he doesn't, you know, his feelings on his own community are complicated, couldn't one of you have been from the community, one of those two communities? You had two choices, right?
Right, like, exactly.
But also, again, there is representation, as Sonia says in her article that you mentioned earlier, is sort of one of the only, it's like documentary film and media, it's one of the only tools we have one of the most powerful to tell our stories and to have our, you know, to get our perspectives out there. And for us, it's so much more is at stake than just like right. an award. It's also about, mm-hmm. some of this is about our survival. You know, some of this is about, it's literally about reversing, you know, trying to, in some ways, counter all the damage that has been done all these years right. by having our stories told through a white supremacist lens. And the only way to counter that is to, again, hand the narratives back to us. Exactly. And so I think that, so the question was about that. And there was a huge response from predominantly, if I may say, Black and brown women, mostly who are many who are members of Brown Girls Stock Mafia, one of the organizations, again, that's been doing the work, you know, over the last number of years around these issues. And it was very, you know, it was, so, and it became sort of a big deal, you know, I guess I kind of went viral, and some articles came out about the issue afterwards about, you know, what was touted to be the backlash. But really, when I think about it, it was really just the question was, again, something, you know, it was, I feel like it was fairly mild, you know, like what
the question was, I think about Aretha Franklin, Think, you know, the song Think, you know,
Think.
Like, yeah,
being an ally means more than just
thinking,
than posting like Black Lives Matter,
right,
or even protest. It means actually like making the change within your own life, you know, like we, and again, BIPOC people and LGBTQ people every day have to negotiate the world in a completely different way, right? We have to think about,
we have to be, we have to be aware of them, particularly as a BIPOC person, them as the other. And then Jessica, what are your thoughts on this? And also, where did you come in to this as a true ally? But actually, I prefer the word, I've grown to disdain the word ally. I prefer co-conspirator. Because co-conspirator means that you are in cahoots with me to get what I need. Ally, you could just say, oh yeah, I like you people. You know, I support you people.
I like that too, because it also holds like an ongoing responsibility. There's something about calling yourself an ally that like assumes a fixed position. Like, I'm here, I'm an ally, and actually, like, as a white person committed to dismantling white supremacy, that's an ongoing process, and co-conspirator kind of signifies that, which is a really, you know, interesting framing. And white supremacy should really be white people's problem to solve. Like, Gita, what you did was really moving and galvanized so many people. And like you just said, it was like majority women of color responding on that thread, and consistently over and over, like, being vulnerable and putting yourselves out there to hit this drumbeat. And I think, you know, I really hope that in this kind of reckoning stage, we're really thinking about mechanisms for institutional accountability and ways of supporting representation, access, equity, authorship, and not just letting them kind of become buzzwords that like we can say to show we're in position next to, you know, like, we, like, as white folks, we're aligned with BIPOC causes, as straight folks aligned with queer causes or whatever, that it's actually, you know, much more, we need a much more systematic approach to counter these kinds of systematic inequalities.
Yeah, and there, I mean, you mentioned buzzwords. That's something I'm already noticing. Like, I have been on meetings where white folks in particular are using anti-racist rhetoric while they're practicing racist practices. And it's just shocking. It's just shocking. I found it particularly infuriating. And then I wonder, is this something that's conscious, or is it something that, because I say it, therefore I'm actually doing it, which is not saying and not doing, or saying and doing are completely different things. I wonder about that. I mean, the way I describe it, you know, these people think they're fully woke, but they're like in an unresponsive coma.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have a lot of cognitive dissonance in the field politically because we see ourselves as social justice oriented and like liberal. And so like, of course, we believe like we're against oppression and for equality, broadly speaking, but it's not an orientation, it's an ongoing practice. And I think, you know, that cognitive dissonance is really sort of like a trap door for people in positions like with positional power to not address their own privilege.
Right. So I just want to kind of talk about a little bit about the ethics around storytelling. Primarily, we've always mentioned authorship and essentially folks within particular communities being able and put in a position to tell their own stories. But also there's a question of who has access to the people in those communities, as well as, I mean, another huge piece, access to the funding. So I'll start with you, Jessica. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also such a systemic problem in the industry in terms of representation and in terms of what it means for different filmmakers to be proven or to be risky. Like, when do young women of color, how many films do you have to make to not be risky anymore? Like, Geeta, when in your career, which is long and decorated, did people stop treating you like a risky choice? I'm genuinely curious, you know, like the thresholds are different for different people. And our model at Multitude Films is really built to address this and support. Like, we produce only films by and about underrepresented voices. That we're committed to the majority of our slate being emerging directors, and also produce the majority of our films independently, because it's both about, it's both a resources question and resourcing stories by and about underrepresented voices, but it's also the way independently financed films preserve authorship, because it keeps creative control in the hands of the people who should be telling those stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's another point you bring up, Jessica, which Geeta I'd like to speak to, about the constant need of having to prove yourself. So I'm thinking about Ava DuVernay's show Queen Sugar, and how she's always made a point to have women directors. And I can't remember her name because I'm awful at names, but the woman who did the film Real Women Have Curves, which was at Sundance in the 90s, and look at all this acclaim, and Latina. And she, her work with Ava DuVernay was like maybe her first or second like directing job after such a 20 something years in the business. Or you think of someone like Julie Dash, who is one of the best filmmakers out there. And I actually had the opportunity to meet her at IFP Week last year, because she was raising money for her new documentary. And I'm thinking, like, why is Julie Dash here? Like, taking these decision-making meetings. I mean, people should just be giving her money, you know? like, did you not see Daughters of the Dust? You know? But success for people in BIPOC communities and for filmmakers with disabilities and for filmmakers in LGBTQIA defending, there's a higher threshold that has to be met, that's assumed that needs to be met, that actually we don't even get the opportunity to meet. So Geeta, could you speak to that?
I'm sorry, I just want to make sure which part, because you said a lot right there. Which part of it?
Just having to, as a person of color, as basically a non-white male person, let's make it simple. Okay, if you are not white, if you're not able-bodied white male, then basically you don't have the luxury of mediocrity. Even when you have phenomenal success, you still don't have the resources that a mediocre white male can get.
No, so. That's absolutely right. Well, you just said it, so I don't know that I'm
okay.
Like, yeah, you just hit it on the head. I mean, I can speak to my experience around that. I think as, you know, generally as women, as people of color, and as BIPOC folks, as anyone who is, you know, if you are of the, again, the LGBTQ plus community, just the standard, you know, if you are functioning within or trying to function within what is ultimately a white supremacist industry, you know, if we all start from just the perspective and the truth that this is a white supremacist society and everything a white supremacist, you know, again, Christian, heteronormative, you know, mm-hmm. society, able-bodied, et cetera, these are all the expectations of what you should be to be set up for success. Anyone outside of that has to work five times as hard, is expected to, you know, can never, you know, the opportunities to make a mistake are, you know, basically your first mistake can technically be your last. I think the, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. this, the end and the career arc of someone, again, who is not, you know, what you just, you know, what we just talked about, who is not white, heteronormative, et cetera, can often take much, much longer. And Jessica, you asked, like, at what point am I not seen as risky? I'm still seen as risky. And mm-hmm. I'm particularly probably still seen as risky because now I have a big mouth. You know what I mean?
Yes. So,
like, it's just like we are, to be, you know, completely transparent, you know, it's like you have to either work within the system and go along with the system, right, to kind of move forward. But even in that process, you will see your white counterparts mm-hmm. move past you, make films, you know, about your community, make films about, you know, and then perhaps just need you sometimes as a beard, you know, perhaps just need you. Like, there's, and I'm not, you know, that's not just specifically my experience, but just speaking to, you know, the larger, these are the stories that I've heard. Like, there is like a sort of, unfortunately, that is the way that it seems to go. And this is at the, again, at the level of the gatekeepers too. How many executives of color are they who are greenlighting the films, you know, mm-hmm. that we can name? Like, it's like you can count folks on maybe one, not even, you know, one hand. You can count them on fingers.
Right.
So mm-hmm. it starts from the top down and there's a trickle down effect. And, you know, and folks tend to continue to greenlight and provide resources to filmmakers that they are comfortable with, you know, and that tends to do with, again, there's, you know, a certain status quo that just keeps repeating. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, it's the reason that certain production companies have 20 films at a time, all that mm-hmm. one filmmaker is directing. You know,
I feel like people who actually are making films, at the most, they can maybe make one or two at a time. Now, if you have a production company and you're making 20 films, I don't know.
And then you're directing all of them. It doesn't make, but or,
it doesn't make least, sense.
Even a quarter of them. But I think too, but this also goes into the fact that we've moved into like this corporate age of docs where mm-hmm. filmmakers are seen as almost branded, right? But it's like, they're seen as part of the branding of a film. And also then there's a feeling of like, if I invest my money into this person in this company, they'll deliver somehow, right? Mm-hmm. It just creates this vicious cycle for people who are trying to get a foot in the door that you can't get your foot in the, you know, you can't get a job, right? You can't get that job unless you already have the track record. But how can you get the track record?
Track record.
Mm-hmm. If you're constantly, you know, if the jobs are constantly going to the more established people, right? What is the way? What is mm-hmm. the way in at this point for people who are sort of seen as being marginal or on the margins, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to ask too. So there's been more talk about this corporatization of documentary. I just feel like that's not going to last. You know, because only a handful of people will be able to benefit from it. And I know there are more investors getting involved in the documentary space, but investing in docs is a very different world than investing like in a narrative piece. So I know that has been all the buzz, I would say, the past year, but like, I wonder what the longevity of that will be. Jessica, do you have any thoughts?
So first of all, I think, you know, largely investors, and I'm talking mostly about like individuals and smaller like companies around executive producers, are coming with like a varied value proposition, usually, where they're, you know, often looking at how to regenerate a pool to continue putting it into more films. And certainly if they were trying to solely increase their wealth, there's many more effective ways to do that. When I'm talking about like the commercialization of the industry and like the corporate impacts, it's much more around how a few big players like the Netflixes of our industry can come in with seemingly to us arbitrary decisions each year and create these drastic market fluctuations that we're responding to. We're responding to as filmmakers and how we're structuring our films. And when I say filmmakers, I mean producers and directors. We're responding to them. The funders are responding to those kinds of sales. We respond to them in terms of like a rumor mill. It's like, you know, first Netflix is, or Hulu, all the places, all the streamers are going to be producing their own content, and there's no place left to sell films in at market. And then like, still we're seeing films sell at market. And then there's like, you know, at the beginning of COVID, there's like the rumors of like, Netflix is going to buy up, there's going to be like a rush on films, and it's just like, these things aren't happening. But it's also about how does it impact how we're set, like the goals we have when we're setting out to tell these stories in the first place, and where we want our films to be and what we want to be doing with our films when there's entities with really different goals. How can we organize ourselves to leverage our power as the creators of value in this space in order to ask for what we want? And what we want is to work with them and have the flexibility and ability to do, you know, to reach our broader goals with the films, whether that's around impact or whatever that might be. I think there's a lot of people in the space grappling right now in the doc field, I mean, grappling right now with like, how can we as institutions and individuals organize ourselves in order to put a stake in the ground around our values and goals for our films and our careers vis-a-vis some of these corporate interests, and in a way that isn't, it's not an us against them, because like I said, we want to be working with all of the big players. Like for some films, you know, for some films, Netflix is the dream. For other films, PBS is the dream. It really depends on a film and their goals. And right now we're looking at, right now we're often addressing these questions in a film by film way rather than a sort of collective strategy. And I wasn't around yet in the industry during like the organizing days that led to ITVS and other organizing periods, and there's been a number of articles surfacing some of these efforts, like the new Ford Beyond Inclusion report and some of Sonia and Natalie's article. And I think really connecting with our history in the field, and then thinking through what tools are at our disposal that can address the problems of this time.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely a question of power, and really storytellers, filmmakers reclaiming the power, because you all have the content, you know, and those of us who work on the industry side, like we would be nothing, like I have a job because of you all. So recognizing that. But this is one thing I wanted to talk about, really around the power dynamics and some of the things that I've noticed in my doc career, being on the industry side. I'm doing my day job. I oversee a fiscal sponsorship program, and I have read hundreds of applications and have been first on the front row when in regards to proposal, in regards to proposals, that at times deal in extractive storytelling. And it's always very clear when I read something from someone who is not part of a community. They will say things like, there's never been a story told about this. In particular with Native Americans folks, they will say that there are something like they just discovered that Native Americans still existed, 5 years ago when they read a book. That they'll say things, there are no Native American documentary filmmakers. And I've had to have a lot of hard conversations with some of these filmmakers. And one of the things they say is, well, we want to raise awareness about this, whatever particular issue. And this is really something that came out that was really glaring these past few months in regards to Black Lives Matter. Because it seemed like a lot of white filmmakers, because they were making a film about a Black person, even if it was a Black synthesizer, this relates to Black Lives Matter. And, they want to say that it's going to raise awareness. And my question is, raise awareness for who? Because of people in those communities? I think they're aware of their situation. What are you doing beyond that? And it's really hard for them to say, okay, I'm really making this film for a white audience. It's really hard for that to come out of their lips. And then I also ask the question, well, how is the community going to benefit from this? And that stops people in their tracks because they haven't thought about that. So in regards to the meaning and needs of the filmmakers who are telling their own stories. There's also a need to address the communities whose stories are being told in a safe way. What's one way we can help try to rectify that? Because there seems to be this very clear disconnect, and people aren't asking themselves the questions, am I the right one to tell the story? They think because they quote unquote discovered the story, and no one knows about it, that they are the right one. And that's not enough.
I just want to say the idea that anyone discovered a story about a community isn't their own, right? The idea of saying that no one knows the story, like you said, before, is, factually untrue, because that community knows about that story. Mm-hmm. So who's no one? Who is the no one you're referring to?
Yes, name it.
Maybe nobody outside of this community knows that story. Mm-hmm. But I think this is where, again, the sort of, as far as ethics of the actual filmmaking process, I think the question is there somebody from the community who should tell this story? Mm-hmm. And I may be the person who has access to, the funding, as an established filmmaker, but, absolutely, is there someone from that community that you can supply with that access, but the funding, the resources, the access to, again, gatekeepers that, could tell that story, or the, to platforms that you may have? That is really probably, mm-hmm. I think when you think about the ethics and accountability of it, that's one of the things you should do, because someone of that community, ideally, and this is not always true, because I don't mm-hmm. want to also stereotype us in some way as we're not all saints who are working for the same cause, but someone from that community would at least sort of, again, understand the nuances of the issue, understand the complications of the issue. And then too, ideally, if they are trying to change it, would know what the community needs and would want to see that through. Mm-hmm. I mean? As to someone else, again, oftentimes there's this thing that we do. And this is also with when you think about even NGOs who come in,
yes.
It's like, know what they need, to come in to rectify a situation. you know, or to try to offer help. The people who know what is needed are the people who are actually living it and are on the ground and have probably been doing all kinds of organizing without you
already,
you know, already. So why don't you ask them, or why don't you just give them the funds and let them set up a system, you know, or continue building the system, you know? But that's what you could, that's sort of the best thing you can do. They, you know, and I think similarly for us, sometimes I think when you look at what can we do, that's what we can do. We can 90% of the time, we can just get out of the way, you know?
Right.
Here's the resources, now get out of the way, you know?
Right.
Like, what they're...
Well, this is related. And to me, it's all rooted in paternalism. Like this idea that like I know better. And I mean, this is related. There, I think last week, there was a few articles about, well, there's this article I posted on Facebook about, you know, scientists are confused about the lack of spread of COVID in Asian and African countries. And I'm thinking, it's not confusing at all. They actually took it seriously in those countries. They set up protocols. I've been talking to filmmakers all around the world. I mean, they had like a fraction of, like, in, for example, the South Africa and the Congo, they had a fraction of the cases that we had here in the United States, and they have instituted these immediate lockdown procedures. South Korea probably has the most vigorous system of contact tracing. You know, it's not mysterious, but it's mysterious to the Western view. Like, how did these brown and black people figure out this thing before we did? I'm like, just do a Zoom call and talk to these scientists, you know? But it speaks to recognizing that you can learn from these communities, but also asking folks for what you said, Gita, like asking people, well, what do you need? And how can we make that happen? And then giving them what they need, not what you think they need. Yeah, but it's not mysterious. And I don't even know if it's my job to figure this out, but like, what is the resistance to asking the question? And then saying, yeah, you know, I would like a bacon cheeseburger. Like, give me a bacon cheeseburger.
I think it's what you said, but it's paternalism. It's also part of like white supremacy, right? Or just the idea of colonialism is that, no, my way is better. I know better. You know less. You're somehow inferior. You have less information than me. I'm here to save you from yourself, you know? And I think that's
the white savior.
Yeah. But that's what's been, I mean, that's the definition of colonialism, right? Like, so what's been happening in our world, you know, since forever. So I think that this is something that folks still operate in that way, you know, and again, we live in a white culture here in this country is dominant, right? It's white dominant culture. That's what we speak about. So the idea that that would not be the only way or the always the right way is, you know, something again that we have to work to dismantle.
And the very idea of thinking about that really rocks some people's worlds. Like they can't handle that.
Yeah. And I love the story that you just shared working as a gatekeeper and the kinds of questions, like probing questions of different projects. And I think like, you know, grant funders, fiscal sponsors, of course, and also some of like awards, you know, centers of gravity, like, can we have mechanisms where like film teams need to be making the case for why they were the right ones to tell this story? And if they weren't, if it's a flawed case, that's gonna count against their ability to get funded and, you know, get an award, and like having like actual disqualifying factors that we kind of accept that like what would it be like if we had like a Bechdel test for authorship and representation, that like a film must do three of these five things in order to pass the test. It's like, you know, an agreed upon three or five things. If it does three of those, it passes the test. It might not be the best case scenario, but it like it's like steering in the right direction. You know, I don't know what that might be, but how could we come to like a sort of shared definition around things beyond some of the buzzwords that will allow us to hold our peers accountable and ourselves also accountable. And we'll have some mechanism of cost in a way. Maybe fiscal sponsorship and grants might not if you're at some stage in your career, though those are still very relevant for most everyone working in the industry. But awards certainly would have implications for even like the most prominent and like powerful doc filmmakers.
I mean, I definitely consider myself a gatekeeper, and like one of my frustrations sometimes working in this industry is I've raised the alarm about certain projects and have been overruled. Mm-hmm. Because of the status of the filmmaker or the visibility of the filmmaker or the fact that they're going to be bringing money in. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother said, not all money is good money, you know? Mm-hmm. And so what do you think about the, what other types of measures need to be brought
on? That's why, like,
yeah. And but also I want to talk to you, I can't remember this, the panel you were on, Jess, or the, I think the panel you moderated, Jessica, for Getting Real. Was that the one you were talking about data, like the importance of data and transparency? I can't remember. Or was that one that Gita was on? I don't know. They were both really good, but I can't remember who said what or which.
There's been a couple of panels for sure where this has been talked. But data absolutely is one of the few ways that we can actually hold people accountable, you know, or hold companies and institutions accountable. You know what I mean? Like when you look at numbers, you know, they don't lie. Like, you know, when you talk about staffing, when you talk about, you know, even freelance staffing, when you talk about, you know, also to where the money is going, you know,
right?
Like, filmmaker color and how many production companies, you know, that again are not just, you know, that are not straight white male owned, are you funding?
Right.
The numbers, you know, again, set up a system of transparency and accountability that can't be denied. So it's important to have that information, I think, to help build as a tool to help build equity.
Yeah. So ideally, like what kind type of data would you like to see collected?
I think, you know, yeah, there's... Yeah, there. I think like, what would it look like to you know, somehow anonymously, but pull back a veil around fees people are getting paid, who's getting paid, what kind of fees for their above the line roles, fees per scale of the film, and how and when they're getting paid those fees. You know, if it's like financed incrementally and then sold, do they get it like 7 years later? Are they getting it along the way? And then also, you know, if we're pitching commissioned projects, what budget levels are different filmmakers getting and what fees do those include? All of that's really important, but also, I'm really interested in, so in the 2018 State of the Field report, the Center for Media and Social Impact and Katie Borum Chatu and her team showed data that that 56% of filmmakers received less than $25,000 in income for their last film, and that 22% of those films only made enough revenue to cover unpaid production costs and go into profit. So that means like starting at $1 and up, only 22% of films made enough of that. And that 22%, I think, is really, really interesting because we're looking at some of these big ticket sales of like several million and multi-million dollars. And then what in that profit chunk, what, you know, where's the center of gravity? Where are the majority of films falling? And then the third piece of data I think is also related to waterfalls of different films, and how different films that are financed independently, including with investment, are how does the money flow down that waterfall? And what does that look like for different people, given the different kinds of choices you can make about how you structure your waterfall?
What about you, Gita? What kind of data do you think needs to be collected?
I don't have much to add beyond what I also think there's something interesting too about audience data, you know, that the other too, like, and which might be more challenging, but part of this sort of idea of like who watches the films that get made too, because I think a lot of what the networks and also, sort of venues now that, that use even streaming, there's a lot of talk from them about what is risky for them. This is a risky investment. We don't have that audience. So that, the audience will... Or this is not mainstream enough. What does that mean? Want to make films about sort of, again, maybe BIPOC communities or the LGBT communities that we've mentioned before, like, this is too much of a risk because, our audience doesn't tune in. Well, I'd like to see the numbers around, other things you've done like that, that speak to it, to that.
But also I feel like that, that audience, I feel like it's a lot of times this audience excuse, there's not an audience for that. We are our audience, and when they say that, they're not talking about us, and like we watch our own content. And that argument was, they consistently use that despite the facts, which, and I'm specifically talking about like narrative Hollywood, because if you look at the financial success of films like, Black Panther and Crazy Rich Asians, it wasn't just Black folks who were going to see Black Panther. It wasn't just Asian folks who were going to see Crazy Rich Asians. There is an audience for them. It's just you want to continue to perpetuate this. Really, it's almost like this mythology, this narrative that you're holding on to because you want to keep the status quo in a way.
That's right. And documentaries are very much, already seen as niche,
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's, of the risk of being, too niche within already what is seen as a niche, is frightening to, like funders and gatekeepers, et cetera, who, make the decisions from the top down about what gets funded and what gets seen and what ends up on there,
I think documentary has an advantage in that it is so niche, and particularly when documentary filmmakers absolutely have to know clearly who their audience is and who that film is going to appeal to, and also how to get that film out there. And when you think about social justice films that are made from folks from that particular community, a lot of those filmmakers are on the ground and marketing to specifically to those communities. And they're doing the on the ground grassroots work to do that outreach. So I mean, that's a solid audience, and but a lot of times that particular audience is ignored, because it's not like white straight suburbia.
Mm-hmm. No, that's absolutely true. I think white audiences are still seen as the audience that spends the money, the audience that, at least at box offices for sure. I think there's an interesting thing happening now with this in this time period where we are seeing, a lot of films just go possibly straight to streaming because of what's happening, in our view, obviously to COVID. But I think that to discount the audiences again of BIPOC people is a huge mistake. Like when you look at, and this is not documentary film, but when you look at someone, and it's very complicated, but a filmmaker like, and again, not speaking about necessarily about his work or what it means, but a filmmaker like Tyler Perry, who essentially built his entire, his entire industry, off of Black
Eyed. I remember living in Atlanta when we was getting started and my mother dragging me to his gospel plays on Sundays, like after church. I'm like, oh my God, this is too much. you know.
And now, yeah, he is a billionaire and yeah. has a studio that rivals anyone else's. So that's, it's mm-hmm. a very, I think you, again, discounting, I think the issue we really have to think about is that a lot of these places really just see things in terms of numbers. You know what I mean? There's, mm-hmm. they want to know what the revenue is, and that is being perhaps strangely applied at this time to also to documentary film.
It's also like the relationship between the revenue a film generates and the marketing budget that's applied to that film. Like all the films that you just listed had huge, huge marketing budgets. And that's also why they reached a lot of different audiences. And you know, I think there's like another phenomenon where like a lot of the, you know, for example, in the wake of the uprisings following the murder of George Floyd, there's been like a lot of people from all around the industry, like reaching out about, you know, a variety of stories that can speak to these questions of racial justice and police violence in particular. And it becomes a kind of not just sensationalized, but like tokenized approach to following like trends, like what's trending in a thing, and that's just such a disappointing way to be engaging these stories.
Yeah, because that's actually raises a great point I wanted to go to. Because people, there seems to be this desire to, like you said, follow quote unquote trends, but also doing something like perform, like in that's really performative, in out of a fear of like what people are now calling like a fear of cancel culture. And I'm still trying to figure out really like what, I do know what cancel culture is, but the people who are touting it as a response to the legitimate concerns that filmmakers who have not had access to opportunities, as an answer to that, I find incredibly disingenuous. And that's what I think, because in the article about Tigergate, that I think was in Variety, I read some of the comments out afterwards, and there is a lot of fear about, oh, well, they're about to get canceled. You know, we need to get rid of cancel culture. And that's not it at all, you know?
Yeah. Cancel culture, it's like, we should definitely cancel behaviors, and we should definitely be able to say that, you know, your behaviors are continually causing me harm, and so I will not be in community with you any longer. You know, there are ways that social media becomes toxic and very quick moving that doesn't allow for the kind of relational approach to that conflict that we can otherwise have, which Geeta, you took that relational approach offline as well as online stuff. And if like what we're worried about the most is like, will folks that we're holding accountable be canceled, then like we just have our center of gravity completely off course.
That's not the problem. And the cancel culture, the sort of the idea of, I agree with Jessica absolutely that, you know, social media doesn't necessarily always give the context that we, you know, we wish it did. And it doesn't always, you know, can it be toxic? It certainly can be. But I think the reality, it's like of, you know, again, if you have been doing the right thing, the fear of being canceled, you know, shouldn't really impact you.
Yeah. If you're doing the right thing, you don't have fear of being canceled.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I mean, like, you can certainly somebody can call you out or say something about you on social media that may not be true, but mm-hmm. the truth will always come out. So my point is cancel culture, that term is often used by, I think, by folks and by institutions that are resistant to change, you know, that are, it's a way to sort of to resist and to when you want to remain comfortable in things in the way that they are, which may be harmful and oppressive to others, you know, when you cite cancel culture, it's like, well, you know, you've been canceling us and for how long, you know, you're this.
this cancel how does culture. It feel? Yes. How does it feel? Cause yeah, we have been canceled.
Yeah. We've been like, you know, this is just sort of, we're not trying to cancel anyone. Honestly, nobody wants that. We really, the goal of this is to build an equitable and, you know, sort of equal system where we can all thrive, right? We just
share the pie,
just share
instead of eating it all yourself.
They ask us to to again and to actually practice again in our community, particularly in just in a lot of these the arts communities, right? In general, tend to be lean towards progress or at least want to lean towards progress, but in doing that we just again it's the ask is to just actually practice what you preach, you know. It's as simple as that, and look around you. And I think unfortunately there's some there's a learning curve with that, which we people may I think for a lot of folks in our community there's a some have been kind of, again, some co-conspirators may have been on this trajectory for a while already and with anti-racist work. And, but I think there's folks who, for whom it's new. So, okay, fine. Nobody, but just try, the ask is like, do the work. Actually do the work, don't be performing. That is really the ask.
Right. And with that said, we absolutely need more, more co-conspirators to take on that role, because I know as a Black woman who is 49, I no longer engage in the often thankless work of explaining racism to white folks. I don't want to expend my energy in that area anymore. I want to work on my healing and the healing of my people. That's what
I want to
focus my energies on.
Yeah. That's what Ibram X wrote. He has a book that everyone can enjoy. You know what I mean? I'm like, there's research for that other people have already done the work around, you know what I mean?
I can't do it anymore. Cause I'm almost 50, Lord have mercy. But I'm just thinking, I don't have the time. I have white co-conspirators in my life who are actual co-conspirators who I've never had to explain. I was about to use a word, which I'm not going to use a word because this is going to not like it, but I haven't had to explain things to. And so I think that's why we need those co-conspirators to step into those roles, to take on explaining to their people, I do it, I'm a straight Black woman. So in Black spaces, if I'm in a space where homophobia is raising its head, I speak up. I make it very known, not here and not around me. I question it, I stop it, and I'm learning about my own internalized ableism. So I'm learning to check myself. I consider myself, I'm a work in progress,
I just want to speak to that too in the industry, because I think, and for myself as well, I mean, honestly, we all have, again, because of what, the way our society works, we all have that work to do. I mean, many folks who are non-Black, are oftentimes to position themselves as much as possible as to be as white adjacent as possible, and that absolutely a huge problem. So this, as Jessica said, I think so rightly, it's not an orientation being anti-racist and sort of anti-homophobic and anti-everything else we've met. It's not an orientation, it's a practice. It's a daily practice, for some folks who are very used to it or entrenched in, you know, in sort of the society as it is, it's going to it makes people uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable. It's like having to change your ways to build a healthier society and a healthier community, you know, but it's ultimately like everyone benefits from that. Everyone benefits from it.
Everyone. Yeah. Yeah.
There's nothing. I think there's also a, unfortunate deficit mentality that comes with our industry and, mm-hmm. you know, society of like, well, if someone else has some, that means I have less. And that's not the case here. Mm-hmm. It is not mm-hmm. the case, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, Ranelle and I, we actually, organize a convening, for Getting Real, our day job with the IDA, of Indigenous filmmakers. And they opted for it to be closed. But the work of that like started in 2018, soon after Getting Real 2018, Ranelle came to me, hey, like, you wanna help me plan a convening of Indigenous filmmakers? And I was like, yeah, because I got my start in documentary. I wouldn't be in documentaries today if it weren't for the Black Association of Documentary Filmmakers West. I went to my first meeting. I came to LA and was not even interested remotely in docs, but I went to my first meeting, got interested in docs through that organization. I got my first gig, which led to everything else, you know, 10 years later now. So I know the importance of having like those closed spaces where people can interact. And it really was incredibly affirming and incredibly like, relational process versus like transactional process, and collaborative process, because we talked to folks we knew, they made introductions, they connected us with organizations out there, and Ranelle and I's role was essentially, okay, we want to provide you the space, and you decide what you want to do with it, and there's a lot of coordinating to make that happen. And like I was very proud. We had a call this morning and I kind of cried a little bit because I was very proud of our co-conspirator role and making this happen. And of course we're looking forward to seeing how this will be birthed into other things. But in addition to like supporting our own communities, it's also, you know, we are about this, but we are really committed to those of us who had similar oppressions, hopefully are committed to supporting each other, even though we're not part of those like individual specific constituencies.
Yeah, I mean, intersectionality is like both a value and a strategy, because we have more power when we're working together against these systems that are against all of us. And I'm really with you in that.
I agree too. I think that's critical. And I think we have to, like, again, in our daily lives, have to look at how we are supporting, uplifting, you know, mm-hmm. Again, in community with other filmmakers, also from filmmakers, organizations, institutions that, you know, are doing the work. So right. Really, really critical.
And also, like, there's the big sort of initiative kind of level of co-conspirator work, but there's also just sort of like the daily ways that we can show up to dismantle white supremacy, heteropatriarchy, each of these things, where it's just like a vigilance of attentiveness to how am I enabling and upholding white supremacy in my daily life? How is my internalized homophobia playing out in relationship to this person, you know, as a queer person? Or just these kind of constant questions that we have an opportunity to like address in relationship with each other and in our work and in our families.
Right. And I mean, that's something I look at too, because I, you know, being like one generation out of Jim Crow, I take that lived experience into my daily work. So I do not privilege entitled white folks. You know, I treat every filmmaker the same. And I have been at times sometimes reprimanded for that because I'm not giving the special treatment, particularly when that special treatment is taking away from others. And these are like some of the consequences, but you know, I'm fine with that because I can look at myself in the mirror.
Absolutely.
And, but it involves like constant vigilance, but also being able to kind of like stand up against like certain forces. So I wanted to talk about, cause I know we're like, I want to talk about some of the possible ways that we can deal with some of the pushback. And like sometimes I haven't really had a visceral reaction to when someone uses the phrasing like having the conversation, particularly when they're when I'm raising a particular point that actually needs to be addressed, like I want an answer or at least like a commitment to like planning an answer, and I get thanked for having the conversation. Like in my head, I'm like, don't thank me for having the conversation, you know? No, and I sometimes feel like that phrasing is used as a means to maybe to deflect or not deal, or maybe if I say thank you that I won't have to, or if I have a meeting with this particular group of people about this particular issue, then you know they'll be appeased and then we won't actually have to do anything. How do we get beyond having the conversation? Or if we're dealing with folks who want to thank us for having the conversation, how do we get past them?
Yeah, like we're way past the conversation. Like we're way past the conversation. It's really like what steps are we going to take out of this meeting? This isn't just a conversation. Whatever we're raising here, we need to have action around that. And I think, you know, it's another place where we can't be asking, you know, the people who are raising a particular inequality, whether that's like women of color or queer folks talking about equity. We need to have like, I think, structural field-wide kind of mechanisms for accountability where we're not allowing things to happen as a conversation that don't also include, as a piece of that meeting, a plan of action and commitments, real commitments.
Yeah. Got to demand that. I want to read this quote and just kind of get you all's comments about it. Eddie Ndopu, he's a South African humanitarian and disability rights activist, and I've been following him on Facebook for a while now. And he posted this quote, if my cat will get her behind out of the way, about white privilege. And it goes, why do we speak about white privilege as though it is a precious glass bottle that must be preserved for eternal posterity? Isn't the work of societal transformation about deprivileging whiteness? Shattering the glass bottle so that privilege, which sometimes sounds like a clumsy articulation for freedom, can seep into every crack of human experience? I can't help but wonder if the language of privilege belies what we truly mean: entitlement, arrogance, dominance, and violence. So want to get your thoughts on that in regards to what we've been talking about here today.
Entitlement, arrogance, dominance, and violence. You know, it's like the escalation of those pieces. And I just also want to point out that your cat was high-fiving you as you were reading that, which I think is awesome. I think there, what that reflects for me in terms of how white supremacy functions in our industry is Even how we're having these conversations, as you just said, can still sometimes function as centering our own whiteness and reiterating our power and privilege rather than dismantling that. And I think that's something for, like, as a white person and in other kinds of positional and structural power and privilege that I have, or we each have in different ways, it's really, yeah, it's on me to do the work, you know, it's on us to do the work in those ways. But I think I'm going to chew on that this evening, as well, just how the very way we're showing up to the conversations can be performative and reiterate and re-entrench our own power.
Gita?
I think I echo much of what Jessica said, which is super powerful, but I feel like that it does make so much sense. The quote that you read is so powerful, because when you think about it, all those things to, you know, are equivalent, well, that's sort of the description, right? All the adjectives that were used, or the, to describe, you know, what white privilege actually is also, they're racism, right? Like, all those things also equate, you know, and add up to, you know, like, perhaps not the entirety, but what racism means, right? And right. So to me, I think that's part of the thing. It's like, if you have white privilege, then by, you know, that is essentially like it's not sort of this isolated thing that you have that, you know, you just kind of carry around with you and has no effect on anyone around you. Like, if you have white privilege, you are engaging, you know, even if you didn't intend to, you know, and you were just born you know, you are engaged in racism, right? It's part of, you have it, it's that, you know, and until you no longer have it, you know, until the society, basically your whiteness does not provide you with privilege, that is this, you know, that is until then, you know, the two sort of white privilege and, you know, racism equate, right?
Right.
So I think that's the thing that is challenging for people to really swallow. And it's not, it's a bitter pill. Like, that's not something, I mean, there's, yeah. I do understand that nobody necessarily asked for that, you know, you didn't ask, but it's the same thing. It's just that if you in any society, if you're of the top sort of strata, right, in a stratified society, if you're of the, you know, at the top, you really have to constantly do the work to, you know, dismantle the society as it stands. And Rinku had this great quote about racism being structured as a ladder. You know, you have people placed on it, you know, but systematically, and the only thing you can do is climb down the ladder, you know, and turn sideways and dismantle it. But you have to do that. You be willing to relinquish it, you know, your in order to create a more equitable society. And that is the big challenge often.
All right. Well, we always like to wrap the show with to ask if our guests have any last thoughts, because we like to give you the last word. So, actually, I had a question. Okay. Recently, one of my colleagues have been working on a series of initiatives that she had been really approached the leadership in our day job many, many times and really got on help with, but it really had gotten very little movement or support. And it really wasn't until you, Jessica, and Gita, along with Marjan Safani, reached out to that leadership where a conversation was finally had, and my colleague was able to get some movement in that space. And that really spoke to me, because especially when we talk about this role of, like, co-conspirators, because a lot of time those of us who are kind of like in this middle management role are working on a lot of initiatives. And sometimes we get support, sometimes we don't. If we can kind of those of us who are like in this middle management role can push on the inside and we could actually engage with you filmmakers, kind of push on it from the outside, then I think we could get some movement. So like what I would like to see is us kind of joining forces in some things. So we as industry folks connecting with you as filmmakers and just like having, you know, just talking and say, hey, what do you need? This is what we're trying to do. Like, how can we support each other? Because again, in some spaces, you know, particularly since all three of you, and I'm including Marjan in that, are very established filmmakers, you have a power that that I don't, you know? So like, I need your help. Like, you need our help.
Of course.
I love that. Just like as an organizing principle where we bring the different kinds of power we have in a collective that's going toward the same goals. And it is true, like the more we're out of our silos and we're speaking cross roles in the industry, and like across the sector from different positions. I think Gita, your group is doing that too. It's not only filmmakers. I can't remember the name of your initiative, but I'll let you talk about that.
Nate, tell us about it.
So there's an initiative that started sort of post Tigergate, which is a collective of filmmakers and then some folks who are also executives and just similarly who came together after that, after I did what I did, and Jessica, these people too, and Jessica and Multitude Films, a number of the folks have been, you know, are part of or sort of organizers for other organizations like ADOC, like mm-hmm. the Black Documentary Collective, like mm-hmm. Also who am I not mentioning?
Brown Girls Doc Mafia,
as I mentioned earlier. So folks came together, and then some folks are just filmmakers, you know, and some people have heard their own production companies, but came together, and we're calling ourselves Beyond Inclusion Working Group. Okay. There were a lot of that were much funnier that we did come up with, but that's the most sensible. And we're going to be hosting sort of a series of roundtables with production companies, and then after that with ideally with gatekeepers, you know, and executives sort of who are in the ilk of streamers, etc. Mm-hmm. To have conversations about really how to, again, and with an agenda on how to move things forward and how to change this, because without the cooperation of everyone, you know, we need everyone to be on board. Right. Oftentimes I think folks may, you know, they may have all the best intentions, but may not really necessarily know what to do. And I think mm-hmm. we can all talk to each other and learn from each other. And also everyone faces obstacles in this because the system was not successful. No system is, right? A system that only very few was always made specifically for that. So we, again, it's working together and sharing perspectives that we can, ideally we can pull it apart and build something better.
Okay. So will people be able to, is that something that's open to everyone to sign up for, or right now it's just working groups?
Yeah, we're doing closed just because in the beginning, I think, as you mentioned, a safe space, you know, to enable.
Yes.
Spaces for people to honestly talk and share about, you know, again, the challenges they've faced, also so they don't, you know, so they can in those spaces perhaps make mistakes, you know, and talk mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. or talk where they feel they have, you know, they've gone right, where they've gone wrong, and where they need help, and, you know, etc. So but I think the goal would eventually be down the line, sure, you know. Okay. But because again, this is still quite tricky and new, you know.
Right. Well, make sure you include us folks in the middle.
Of course.
Sure. Okay, so last words for both of you. Jessica, you go first.
Last words. It's such a big topic, everything that we've been talking about. So I guess what I'm feeling right now is is a lot of energy and appreciation around the relationships and collaboration with people who I'm values aligned with. You know, in my company at Multitude, I'm working with Gita on like 4 or 5 projects right now. Getting to be here with you in this conversation, which will not end as a conversation, but will include next steps. So just really appreciating this.
Thank you. And Gita?
No, I would say too, I'm so grateful to have, you know, again, this is your, you know, that you invited us to this. It means so much. And that we're talking openly about these issues now, not just among ourselves, I think mm-hmm. is an enormously important step in the process and of building the community that we want and the society that we want. And I think I'm thrilled to see people speaking up, you know, to actually, you know, being brave enough to do so and to kind of cast aside fears. Again, there's mm-hmm. been a long history of paying a hefty price oftentimes for doing so, but I feel like the more of us do, the further we get, you know what I mean? We can't all be gotten rid of. So like, again, we can't all be canceled. So if we continue to move forward in this way, it gives me a lot of hope for the future.
All right. Well, thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Gita and Jessica remind us of the need for constant vigilance in the face of systems that were built for only a select few. If you are one of those select few, ask yourself, are you the right person to tell this story? Self-reflection is key, and an unexamined life is a life not lived. But filmmakers, you must remember that you have the power because you create the content. Demand the changes that you want. Demand accountability. Ask for the data. And when an organization is non-responsive, is vague, or attempts to deflect your calls for change, refuse to be satisfied with that answer.